Hello and welcome to another episode in the Two Time Labs podcast. I'm Francis Wade, and this week I have a very special guest. Her name is Julie Dirksen, and she's an industrial design expert, someone with a background in designing and thinking about design and thinking about how people learn. Matter of fact, she's an author of an awesome book that I strongly recommend called Design for How People Learn. And she's calling us here in Jamaica from Minneapolis, where it's very cold. Julie, how are you?
I'm good. I'm trying to stay warm, but the cold keeps trying to infiltrate the house. So, although today's actually our warm day, tomorrow it's going to be much colder. So,
I said I want to throw the problem at you, so that we can sort of bat it around for an hour or so and see what kinds of solutions we come up with. Maybe something we haven't even thought of before, either of us separately. How does that sound?
Sounds great.
Wonderful. Okay, so here's the problem that we have, or in my world, time management world. Learners recognize that they have some symptom, and they don't want the symptom because it could be that their life is out of balance, could be that they feel stressed, they're overwhelmed, they're missing appointments, they're running behind, they're constantly rushing, email is killing them, they have information overload, and so on and so forth. So they go looking for a solution. And typically what they do is they either buy a book or sign up for some kind of 1 or 2 day program. And during the 1 or 2 day program, or while they're reading the book, sort of at the very end, the person who's leading the program or who's written the book says, great, so here are you've just heard all the new practices and habits that you need to implement. Good luck. And then
right.
You know, someone might raise a hand and say, "But hold on a minute, wait, but do I have to follow everything exactly? Because I'm looking at the 50 new practices that you just gave us, and I don't think I can do all 50." And the person, the author or the teacher, essentially says, "Well, you don't have to follow everything, but good luck." They left, and the predictable happens, which is, they do their best. They work really, really hard and diligently, you know, while they have a lot of energy and a lot of focus, and they're highly motivated for about a week or two.
Mm-hmm.
And then their cat gets sick, and the boss gives them a new project to work on, and they lose two tires. You know, they get blown out on a highway somewhere, and they lose a whole day trying to get their car repaired, and before they know it, you know, some overwhelming situation has happened, and they revert to the practices that they had before because they don't have the energy to maintain 50 new habits all at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And then they complain that the course doesn't work, book is a crock, or even worse, which I hate to say is sort of more prevalent, they blame themselves. Because during the course and while reading the book, they got the impression that this stuff is so easy and so straightforward. And if I'm failing, then it must be that there's something wrong with me. And it causes them to either never pick up the book, never really diagnose the problem, and just sort of go into a funk.
Mm-hmm.
Is that enough of a problem for us to talk about, or do we need something bigger?
Oh, I got all sorts of thoughts on that.
Where do you want to start?
Well,
it's like going to the doctor.
Yeah. So this is actually really interesting to me because my background, I have a design background, but most specifically my background is actually in design for learning. So I've spent a lot of time in training. I've spent a lot of time in e-learning. And, you know, fundamentally, when we're trying to teach something, and this is for adults largely, not kids, I do a little bit of higher education, but mostly it's workplace. And almost always in workplace learning or education, the goal is to get somebody to do something different. So you're really looking for behavior change. And as a designer, I think the most interesting problems are the hard, chewy problems. And what those usually are the problems where people know the right thing to do, but they're still not doing it for some reason. So that's the area that I'm most fascinated by.
Before they even get into the course, they already know that they should, for example, people now know that they should read all their email. But at the end of every day, 50 messages are unread, and they go home feeling guilty because they know better, but knowing doesn't make a difference, huh?
Right, exactly. So there's a lot of those kinds of behaviors. Like, we know we shouldn't you know, put off the unpleasant email. We should just get it done right now and be done with it so it doesn't nag at us for, you know, for days afterwards. Or we know we should do that, you know, that quick thing now, because then it's just done and it's out of the way. Or we know that if we don't start at least working on the big project a little bit this week, next week when it's due, you're going to, you know, really be suffering and it's going to be painful and unpleasant. And so we know all those things, and yet we frequently don't act on them. And so it's a really interesting thing for me when that occurs and why does that occur? Why? Because we have solutions where it's just a knowledge problem. Like, you just don't know something. There are all sorts of nice tools out there to help you learn that thing. So if you genuinely don't know how to, you know, how to manage your inbox, great, we can teach you how to manage your inbox. But if you know, but still have a hard time doing it, then that's the much more interesting problem for me. And a big piece of that actually is, to my mind, a big piece of that comes down to time issues, and specifically a concept from behavioral economics called hyperbolic discounting. Have you heard of this?
Have heard of, but I couldn't tell you what it means. Go ahead.
Yeah. So the example that I use for hyperbolic discounting when I'm talking about this is, it's basically we discount a reward depending on how far away it is. When I'm talking about this, I usually use the example of, if I were going to offer you $10 today or $11 tomorrow, which one would you take? So which one would you take?
Today or tomorrow?
Yeah, $10 today or $11 tomorrow.
Oh, I'd take the $10 today. Yeah. Thank you, Reverend.
And when I ask,
I don't trust that I'll see you
tomorrow. Yeah, exactly. And when I ask that question of a group of people, I usually get about half. About half the people are like, no, I'll take the $10 today. And then about half are like, no, I'll wait. I'll see. You know, it's worth it. I'll wait a day and for the extra dollar. But if I asked you if you wanted $10 today or $11 in a year, which one would you take?
$10 today or $11 in a year?
Yeah. You take the, I mean, you already said you take the $10 today, even if it.
Well, I like to think of myself as pragmatic or like a saver. So if I put off the $11 till a year from now, I think I'd be saving it.
Oh, it's nice.
A little bit different. Well, I think of myself as a good saver.
Right. Well, and you have a little bit of a different perspective on that, which is actually kind of cool. Yeah. And I'll explain why in a minute. But when I ask that question of a group of people, almost everybody is like, I want the $10 today. Almost nobody is like willing to wait, you know, a year for that extra dollar. But if I said, if I'll give you either $10 today or $1,000 in a year, which one would you take?
Well, $1,000.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, so, and everybody universally says that. I've never had anybody say, no, I'd still want the $10 today. So the issue with that is that the further away a reward is, the more we kind of discount it. So $10, waiting an extra day for a dollar is something that, like I said, about half the people will do. Waiting an extra year for a dollar is something that almost nobody wants to do. And it could be because of uncertainty, it could be because of all sorts of things, but it's a very consistent trend, actually. And when the behavioral economists have done this, they can actually map a very specific curve that happens. So at some point between $11 and $1,000, there's your cross point where you would be willing to wait a year. And it might be, I don't know, a few hundred dollars or something like that, all of a sudden waiting for that reward is worthwhile.
Right.
And so any behaviors where we have a disconnect between either the effort and the reward or the reward and the consequences tend to be the behaviors that are really the tough ones, tend to be the ones that were really challenging. So, for example, if you're a smoker, I'm not, but if you are a smoker, you get all the reward now. You get all the benefit now, but you don't get the penalty until later. And it may never happen, or it may not happen for many years, but you don't see kind of this, you know, you don't see the consequence for a really long time. on the same thing where you have to invest for something that you get later. It's things like eating better or exercising or saving for retirement. These are all behaviors where you have to make the effort or the sacrifice now, and you don't get the reward until sometime in the future. In order for you to be worthwhile, it has to be a pretty big reward. Otherwise, people really have trouble with that behavior.
Whoa. You're making my job really hard.
Sorry.
As someone who teaches time management, it's sounding Sisyphean. It's sounding impossible.
It's challenging.
The people I get in my programs, I typically lead to adults, not kids. So they already have 20 years invested in something they've taught themselves, in some habits that they've learned over the years. So they have an investment in what they already have. So there's already a payoff, which is my life works, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. And I can pay the mortgage. And I may be dying because my email box is killing me and I may be late going to everything. But at least I can pay the mortgage. So some things are working, mm-hmm. because here I am reading your book or here I am in your program. So I don't want to give up the uncertainty. This is even worse. I'm starting to get really sort of like down. I don't want to give up the uncertainty of what you're seeing might happen if I change my behavior, given that I have some certainty about what's already working for me. So I already am getting some immediate benefit, thank you very much.
Yeah.
And you want me to give that up.
Well, but the big issue is by adopting the new behaviors that you're proposing, are they mm-hmm. seeing, how quickly do they see the benefit of that? And that's really one of the questions, because if it takes a really long time for the new behavior to start having some benefit, then that's going to be a tough one. I mean, that's going to be hard for you to convince them to do, and it's going to be a hard one for them to maintain. So if...
No, are there some intrinsic benefits? Because there could be intrinsic benefits from changing their behavior, which come from the behavior itself. Like if I could get them to immediately see some benefits from clearing their email inbox every night, for example. Mm-hmm. That could be an immediate feeling of daily satisfaction.
Yes.
But that's one case. However, the number of things that I encourage them to adopt or they decide to adopt as new habits and practices don't have an immediate payback. So sometimes I put in other goodies like, everybody else is doing it.
Right.
Join the community. We'll all do it together.
Mm-hmm.
Or, some kind of, to use gamification, some kind of badging or... some kind of, you'll be able to follow your progress if you take these steps and you fill in the circles and oh my goodness, how exciting that is.
Yeah, well,
bribes.
and I mean, the issue with a lot of the gamification or the badging or things like that is that making a purely mechanistic reward out of it is probably not that helpful, but being able to visibly see your progress can be really satisfying for people, because that's one of the problems with... that's one of the problems with things like exercise, because you have to exercise for a while before you start to really get a visible benefit from exercising,
right.
Where you can actually start to feel like, oh, it's easier to walk up these stairs or, things like that. And the more that we, that's why there's so much effort looking at kind of quantifying or making it visible. So if I can see myself running faster on the treadmill, and I know that I ran further today in the same amount of time, or that I, maintained a 5-mile-an-hour pace, or, whatever it is, that helps keep me motivated, because I can actually see, yesterday I was doing 4.7 and today I was doing 5, things like that, where we're actually making that visible. And a lot of the devices, the Fitbits or the Nike Fuel Bands or the, different things like that, are about making that progress much more visible to people much sooner. Because if you just had to rely on you feeling better and not having something else that kind of helps you measure making progress, it's very hard to stay motivated about something.
Yeah, I have a friend who has his... I'm a cyclist, and I have a friend who has one of these cyclometer things. Not exactly sure what the heck it is, but it sends up an email, some kind of message to his Facebook account. So when he leaves on the 4:30 ride in the morning... it pings his Facebook account and tells the whole world mm-hmm. that he's riding and how long he's ridden and his average speed at the end of the ride. And the whole, it's like psychic benefit, right?
Yeah, yeah. So it's not so much, I mean, I think the really interesting stuff in gamification is more of that, like making your own feedback visible to yourself and less about, oh gosh, sort of extrinsic rewards. You know, you're going to, if you do all these things, you get a, you know, you get a gift certificate or, you know, things like that. That's not interesting to me, but the making your progress visible, I think is a really powerful mechanism because it helps make you feel like you're accomplishing something right now, as opposed to working towards accomplishing something that's going to happen in the far flung future.
So maybe an example of what you're saying might be showing someone the likely stepping stones of progress. So I'm a fitness junkie, triathlete type of person. And one of the couple of the things that happen once you start working out is that your muscles start to ache.
Mm-hmm.
And of course this happens before you actually see any movement on the scale. The other thing that happens is that your appetite goes up
because
mm-hmm. your body starts to crave calories.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if you could, if I were designing exercise and a particular kind of exercise routine, I would say the first sign of progress is that you wake up in the morning sore.
Mm-hmm.
And what's going to hurt is like your foot, your neck, and your back. And you get to check them off, you know, and say, oh, look, my foot, my neck, and my back, they're all hurting. I'm making progress. Great. That's the first sign.
Well, and that's really great because that actually puts those things in a positive light because they're not positive things if you're trying.
No, they're not.
You know, but actually.
The increase in appetite is also like a bad thing, but that could also be the next checkpoint. Do you all of a sudden have a craving to eat everything in sight? That's another sign of progress.
Yeah.
Because those are actually ways of using the feedback in the action itself. Mm-hmm. It's intrinsic, no?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's see what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, and it goes to this notion, and you've read the books, you know, you're familiar with this. One of the metaphors that I find really useful is Jonathan Haidt's metaphor about the rider and the elephant.
Yes.
And that when you're making decisions about things, your brain has kind of different areas that sort of participate in the decision-making process. You know, so like the very back of your brain, like right down by your spinal cord and things like that, is a lot of your automatic functions. There's some movement things. There's things like breathing and heart rate and blinking and stuff like that. All of these sorts of things that are very automatic. And then you sort of move into your central brain, like right in the middle. You get the things like the limbic system, which is, oh, fight or flight, it controls a lot of, you know, your amygdala, fear responses, a lot of kind of emotional sorts of things. And then up in kind of in front in that area right behind your eyes is your prefrontal cortex, which is where a lot of executive function is centered. And that's the area of the brain that's kind of most developed in humans and sort of more recent how developed that area has gotten. And that seems to be where we're making this trade-off between current and future. There's been a lot of research in animals about how well animals can plan for the future and things like that. Because that seems to be the development of that at the level that it is seems to be uniquely human, even though there's a lot of interesting stuff around kind of how much animals are able to do that kind of like forward planning and thinking. And Haidt's metaphor is he's sort of talking about this executive function, your sort of thinking brain, your logical, rational, you know, obviously I should exercise today, I will feel better, you know, I'll have more energy for the rest of the day, kind of logical, rational brain he talks about that as being the rider. And then all of the rest of it, your automatic, your visceral, your feeling brain, emotional brain, you know, it's not really the part of your brain that talks to you per se. It talks about that as being an elephant. So you've got this logical, rational Mr. Spock brain, you know, kind of trying to direct the elephant. But if the elephant really doesn't want to go there, it's not going to go there. The example I always use is I don't think I've ever run into anybody who hasn't had the experience of, you know, lying in bed when the alarm goes off in the morning and feeling like, okay, I should get up. If I don't get up now, I'm going to be running late throughout the day and it's going to be a problem and I really should get up. And they still hit the snooze button.
this morning.
Yeah, right. So the whole thing, and that's a case where the rider loses and the elephant wins. The elephant's like, mm-hmm. no, I want to sleep more because it's comfortable and it's warm and I like it here. And so whenever we're making decisions, both parts of the brain are engaged in that decision making. And your rational brain is going to say things like, what's the future benefit if I do this thing now? Your elephant's going to go, what feels good? What feels right? What do I want to do? What's going to be comfortable or happy or pleasant or whatever? And what's happening? What do I get right now? I don't care about the future. What do I get right now? And you need both parts, actually, because they've done research with people who have had brain damage to sort of the emotional feeling areas and are really, you know, don't report feeling very much emotion. This is Antonio Damasio. And those people are actually really bad decision makers. You want that emotional tug. It ultimately helps you make decisions. But you don't want, like, the emotional, visceral brain to kind of run everything because that part of your brain is the one that wants to be comfortable right now and wants to be, you know, wants to sit down and kind of hang out instead of being up and doing something or, you know, wants to hit the snooze button.
In essence, you're saying then that for someone who's listening into our podcast is that if they want to make any kind of improvement to the way they manage their inbox, for example, any behavior change, they need to pay attention to what the rider wants versus what the sort of the elephant is demanding.
Mm-hmm.
But then what do you do with the information?
Well, and sometimes it's helpful to me to just recognize when I'm having the feeling of reluctance or unpleasantness or any of those kinds of things, mm-hmm. and be able to kind of pick apart why. Mm-hmm. So if I'm having trouble starting a big task, then I ask my question. Is it a lot of times it has something to do with not understanding, like the task is unclear.
Mm-hmm.
I need to put together a report for a client, but really I'm not feeling confident that I have all the information I need, or I'm not feeling confident that I totally understand what they're looking for, or, you know, things like that. And then that gives me a path in, like, oh, okay, I'm feeling anxious about this because I don't feel like I have all the information I need, then I need to work on getting the clarifying this information, or, you know, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And my elephant, you know, feels like, oh, it's bad, you know, like uncomfortable. So, you know, the temptation to push it aside and do something that is concrete that I do feel clear about is really easy. But the thing that I may be pushing it aside for may just not be that important.
So it's that moment of choice then. Is that with less than full awareness, you would end up just following the elephant because that's the easy path, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With awareness, you could actually, I guess, balance your choice in favor of the rider because you're aware of the elephant as opposed to just being unaware.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a moment. Now, how do you practice that particular, I don't know if it's a skill or it's I think it's an awareness in the moment. How do you know in the moment that, ooh, elephant?
Yeah, well, and that's one of those things that I've gotten, I'm still not necessarily good at all of this, but I've gotten better at when I feel some anxiety about something, stopping mm-hmm. and going, okay, I'm feeling some anxiety about this, what exactly is that anxiety? You know, mm-hmm. like, is it because I'm worried that, you know, what this person is expecting, I don't think what they're going to get is what they're expecting? You know, that kind of thing. Like, is that what the anxiety is? Is the anxiety that I'm not sure? I used to do project management. I don't do it much anymore, but I used to do a lot of project management. So I tried to get better at, as soon as I started to have kind of a bad feeling about something, stopping mm-hmm. and looking really closely at what that bad feeling was and seeing if I could pick it apart. Because I think, you know, you sort of viscerally know, your elephant knows that bad stuff is kind of going on or that something's mm-hmm. unclear, that something's unpleasant. And, you know, the thing about this is we talk about the elephant as kind of the big dumb beast, but the elephant isn't stupid. Mm-hmm. You were talking about the exercise example and the fitness example. A friend of mine got a membership to the local YMCA. And with that membership, she got two free personal training sessions. And so when she went to the Y for her first free personal training session, she thought, okay, he's going to, you know, I'm going to get an orientation to the weight machines, and we're going to set up a little program, and I'll get kind of, you know, I'll learn about what's here and all this kind of stuff. And instead, this woman, like, put her through her paces. She worked her hard. She's doing lunges across the gym floor. She's, you know, like, doing aerobics. She's doing all these things. She's so sore the next day that she can barely move. And we always say that we learn from experience, but if you think about it, what did she learn from that experience?
Don't go back.
Yeah, exercise is horrible is what the, you know, basically what the elephant learned was, that was really awful. I don't want to do that again.
Never return.
And so the elephant's not stupid. That really was unpleasant. And,
right,
you know,
right.
Like you need to do something different. But
right.
But being able to not... The elephant is very good at reacting to those things, but then if you want to make a plan around that, you need to, you know, that's where the rider needs to get back involved and say, okay, well, we're not going to go back to that personal trainer, but that doesn't mean that all personal trainers are bad. You know, can we find somebody else and you know, kind of rewrite that whole scenario but have a better experience doing it, as opposed to, I'm just not going back there. That was horrible. So
right, right. Here's a typical example that we see in the world of time management, so to speak, is that people have an inability to get into what we call a flow state without being distracted by... So they're working on, deeply working on some project. Their smartphone starts to flash, you know, one of those little red lights or green lights or whatever, which says that there's an incoming message. Their mind starts to imagine what the message might be.
Mm-hmm.
It gets anxious because it's thinking, ooh, maybe that's the client who's calling to tell me that my invoice isn't being honored because I forgot to put the. So their mind goes into sort of creating something that doesn't even exist. And in that moment, they have a choice, although they might not know it. Do I leave the work I'm working on and finish the job that I'm deeply engrossed in? Or do I sneak a little peek at all the last 50 emails that have come in the last hour? Just in case the client has actually sent me this imaginary email about my invoice. It's sort of in that moment, for an example in the time management world, that people are at their weakest.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way that they can, I mean, they can hide the phone, which actually isn't, that's more of a structural change where you put the phone away or put it so far away or ask someone to keep it and on the penalty of life and death, don't give it back to me until I'm finished the work. But most people are interested in, you know, how in that moment can I distinguish elephant versus rider? And I think here what you're saying is be sort of present to the anxiety that would cause me to try and take a little sneak peek.
See,
try and get the short-term benefit, even though in the midterm, I'm going to be messing up the project.
Yeah, and this is actually a really interesting one to me, too, because that's a classic case of kind of hyperbolic discounting. The reward that I will get from being able to check that thing or satisfy that curiosity or deal with that kind of open issue that's bothering me is an immediate reward, as opposed to the reward for staying engaged in this project work, which is kind of further away.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a bigger reward, but, you know, staying engaged with the project work is a bigger reward, but it's further away. So we're discounting it for the immediate satisfaction of kind of resolving this anxiety or this curiosity or any of those kinds of things. And there's actually some very interesting research. It's sort of talking about neuroenergetic effect, and this is very sort of hypothetical. And so it's not terribly well established yet, but it was a really interesting kind of theory that I was looking at. One of the big things that influences things like willpower and so forth, it appears to be cognitive load. How much cognitive effort are we expending for something? And there was a study, I know I had it in the book, on cake versus fruit salad, and they had people who were doing tasks that were harder and easier. They were math, and one was like, you know, math. It was either simple math problems or simple math memorization, one or two or three digits, fairly easy problems. And they had a group that was doing much harder problems. And the group that was doing much harder problems, you know, big, longer, complicated math memorization or multiplication or something like that. And then for both groups, they came around about halfway through and they said, you can either have this lovely fruit salad or this delicious chocolate cake as a snack before you go on to the next part of the experiment.
We want cake.
Yeah. The people who had been doing the harder math problems took the cake almost 2-1 over the group that had been doing the easier math problems. So the people who hadn't been expending as much cognitive effort found it easier to make healthier choices than the people who had been expending a lot of cognitive effort. And this is a piece of research that's been replicated in a number of different scenarios and with non-food items and all of those sorts of things. This was Baba Shizen. Anton Fedorkin out of Stanford did that one. But another researcher that's done a lot of work into this whole issue of kind of willpower as a finite resource that you use up is Roy Baumeister out of one of the Florida universities. And he's got a book called Willpower, and he talks about things like decision fatigue. And when we just have to make a lot of choices or a lot of things, we sort of exhaust our mental resources. And, you know, we expend effort on this, and it takes a lot of effort to keep ourselves from, you know, to ignore the phone. I actually really like the fix your environment, don't try to fix yourself. You know,
mm-hmm.
And if you can fix your,
it works.
Yeah, if you can fix your environment by putting the phone someplace out of sight, then great.
Yeah.
I think that's a perfectly valid solution because then you don't have to waste resources resisting the phone. It's just there, not there, and you're not thinking about it.
Right. Or you turn off the flashing light. Because why do you want to be interrupted anyway?
Right, exactly.
Again, a structural solution. But you can't program every structural. Every problem can't be solved with a structural solution, as far as I can tell. Some of them do require this moment of choice that you mentioned.
Yeah.
This decision. This present, being present to the anxiety.
And I guess
what you're saying is, because ultimately, just to sort of bring it back to our listeners, participants in our programs and people who listen into my podcast and who think about time management and getting better and upgrading their system, they're ultimately teaching themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to not only teach yourself in terms of knowledge, you need to manage yourself in terms of behavior change.
Mm-hmm.
And if you know that you're weaker and more likely to make errors of decision, make mistakes, make the wrong decision when you're tired or overloaded, then arrange your time so that you don't have to make the decision when you're tired, no?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and some of that you can kind of set your environment up or your decision-making up ahead of time because it's a lot easier to make decisions for your future self than it is for your current self because of that immediacy issue. There's actually some really interesting research that looked at they were looking at brain scans of people who were making decisions for other people or advice for other people and then decisions for themselves. And your brain patterns when you're making a decision for your future self looks a lot more like your brain patterns than if you're making a decision for another person than they do if you're making a decision for yourself right now. So I realize it's a little obscure, but basically our future self is kind of another person and we can make those dispassionate. You know, it's the easier do what I say, not what I do. You can do that
mm-hmm.
for your future self if you can set that up a little bit. So things like putting your phone away is making a decision for your future self so that I don't have to be distracted by it later or things like that. But then there's other things around there's a concept called implementation intentions, which has been heavily researched by a researcher named, I think it's Richard Golitzer. It's Golitzer is his last name. And he talks about things like, let's say you want to quit smoking. And you want to create implementation tensions about the habits around smoking. And what you can do is sort of kind of create, if this happens, then I will do this, and sort of set those rules up ahead of time so that when you're actually in the situation where you've got the dilemma and what should I do, you already have a decision that you've made. I'm going to do this. So, for example, if I get a craving to smoke, I'll distract myself, could be an example of an implementation intention. Now, a better one is if you can make it more specific. So if I get a craving to smoke because it's after dinner, I'll take a walk. If I get a craving to smoke because I'm stressed out, I'll call my sister. If I get a craving to smoke because I'm bored, I'll play a video game. So having very specific kind of if this happens, then this happens plans already in place mean that you don't have to expend a lot of willpower to implement or as much willpower to implement that plan. and mm-hmm. you can have it. So if there are places where you've identified that you have trouble, like I have trouble when the day gets really busy and, you know, stuff like this. So when the day gets really busy and I'm going to, you know, have problems, I will block out a half an hour on my schedule to deal with things like email and stuff like that. Like have that plan in place before you get to that point. And then, or I will just acknowledge that I'm not going to look at email until the end of the day, or, you know, something that is a pre-existing plan, because then you don't have to expend nearly as much effort around the decision making when it comes to it. You're just like, oh, this is happening, so therefore I need to do, you know, this is what I said I was going to do when this happens. So that's a little bit like fixing your environment, but it's kind of fixing your, having your plan in place before you get to the situation where you have the dilemma or the, you know, decision making that's fraught.
But the thing that's interesting there is it's one step behind fixing your environment, because you're pre-planning the trigger.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying, if this trigger happens, then I'll respond by fixing my environment in this way.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going back one step in the causal chain, I guess, you know, beyond just taking away the smartphone. If I sit down to get into the flow state to work on some project, then I'll take my smartphone and move it to the other room. So the trigger is actually the hard work.
Mm-hmm.
Once you know you're going to be doing that, and you know you're going to be engaged in it. Really not, you know, the concepts are pretty straightforward to understand. They are unusual because we don't manage ourselves in this way to get what we want, do we?
No, not really. And I mean, you know, the thing about most behaviors is that in the right environment, they're functional. Like most mm-hmm. of the things that we do. But the problem is usually that our environment changes ahead of our evolution, essentially. So for
yes.
example...
Oh, that's so true.
So for
Amen.
Right? So for example, you know, one of the things that was a, you know, when we were all living on the savannah and hunter-gatherer societies, an attraction to high calorically dense foods, so sweet things or fatty things or whatever, was a good survival mechanism, because you were barely scraping out, you know, 1200 calories a day. And so if you were attracted to things that were very high calorie, then that meant that you were going to, you know, like you were increasing your likelihood of survival.
Mm-hmm.
And the environment is what's changed on us, and now that behavior is not functional anymore. So the issue is, like, for example, we know that there's, in the US, there's all sorts of problems with obesity. Everybody's getting, you know, heavier. It's a huge issue. But, you know, people haven't fundamentally changed in 50 years. If we go back 50 years, the things that changed are nobody had worried about screen time, and sodas came in 8-ounce bottles, and there was one car per family, and, you know, people walked a lot more, and dinner plates were half the size that they are now, and, you know, all these kinds of things. So the environment has what's changed, not the people. And so trying to get people to overcome these problems in their environment through personal willpower is kind of a problem. It's a sort of a losing game at some level.
We kid ourselves now.
we would actually do much better to figure out how to fix the environment than how to fix the people, because we have, you know, these behaviors are attractive because at one point they were really helpful. So what can we do to kind of make that work better? What can we do? Can we fix the environment? Can I set up implementation intentions? Can I do some of these things? And I mean, you know, some of this willpower helps a lot. I mean, I don't want to pretend that that's not important, or that people are kind of mindless automatons who are just following the script written by their environment. But when we get into some of these really tricky problem behaviors that people really want to change and are still having a hard time with, we really do need to look at, are there things about these, are there automatic behaviors in place? Am I fighting against a usual, I'm fighting against a well-established pattern? Am I fighting against an innate drive? You know, those are all of the kinds of questions that we need to sort of think about. If we're going to try to engineer good solutions. Checking your Facebook status is not a very big reward, but it's an immediate one. It's immediate gratification, as opposed to something that I have to work harder at longer in order to get a reward. So, you know, I make good use of the little program that blocks Facebook and Twitter and, you know, things like that for a few hours if I really need to get something done.
Does it turn itself on or do you turn it on?
I turn it on, but, you know, then it doesn't let me access, you know, certain sites.
You have to be good at responding to the trigger.
Yeah, if I need to sit down and write something, you know, and really kind of get focused and stuff like that, I can take that out of the mix. Now, I can get around it. I can go in and I can turn off the plugin and things like that. So I'm not, you know, it's not like, you know, I can still work around it, but at the same time, it just helps kind of keep me going, oh, right, yeah.
Right. The example I use is of email, that back in the 90s when email first came out and everyone had AOL, you know, getting an email was an event.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the computer said, you've got mail. And you're like, oh, my God, I've got mail.
Yeah.
You told your friends, I got mail. And you got one email a day. And that was like, you know, and the practice that we developed then was to leave our mail in our inbox because it was kind of like a present. It was like this wonderful thing. And the practice, our practice didn't change, which is why, you know, I've met people in my courses who have 40,000 emails in their inbox.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just that the practice that once worked in the mid 90s and just no longer works in 2014.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You can't follow that process and expect to survive. You get buried. And it happens to a whole bunch of people. It's like we just haven't had the awareness to keep up with what's happening in our environment. And the boss requires that, of course, you can't not have email. Pretty soon you won't be able to not have a smartphone. Those just won't be options. And, you know, good luck to you as you're driving on the highway and your phone rings.
Right.
And something in you says, I don't know, that's a good idea. Oh, but that could be the kids, or they could be...
Right, right.
The anxiety kicks in. I've got to get it now or else I... And we do harm to ourselves.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and it, texting while driving is totally one of the behaviors that I'm interested in because it's very much a case of, you know, I know this isn't a good idea, and yet here are all these people who are still doing it, and it's not a knowledge problem. It's not a problem where, you know, just saying, hey, this is a really bad idea is going to change the behavior because everybody knows that, you know?
Yeah. It's very interesting. In the States, the States is a little bit ahead of Jamaica in many ways, and we're ahead in terms of mobile phone ownership. We have like 130% in terms of, there are more mobile accounts than there are people.
Oh, funny.
We're way up, right. People have multiple phones with multiple accounts and all sorts of stuff. And we don't have a law that prohibits texting while driving. We're just talking about bringing one in just right now. So we're lagging. So I'm watching some of the behaviors that people have in terms of they don't want that law to come in because they want to be able to answer the phone and they want to be able to quell that anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to be able to respond. It's almost like it's become a right. And they'll argue that, no, I don't need to. No, I don't have to. No, it's more important for me to get in touch with my kids because it could be my kid calling.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they justify it and argue for it. Forget about the long-term or even mid-term possibility of getting into the immediate sort of rush of anxiety and having it go away by answering the phone. In that moment, it trumps everything, no?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and this whole thing of like the little things that are kind of bugging you, you know, I mean, if you tell people not to think about white polar bears, all they can do is think about white polar bears because it's, you know, so whenever we've got something like that, something where it's open, something that we can't quite close out or resolve or be done with, those kinds of things really nag at us. They're problematic. And there's I started talking about it a little bit earlier, but this sort of neuroenergetic theory. One of the issues with the way that the brain functions is that glucose usage seems to be an issue. So it's basically how much brain fuel your different areas of your brain are using and things like that. So blood sugar and substances like that are what kind of fuel thinking. And so one of the theories around why when we've been working really hard on math problems or whatever, our willpower depletes is because we've got, you know, we've depleted the glucose and until we can kind of refuel that we don't get that sort of willpower back and things like that. And this is a really interesting thing for attention for me is, you know, because one of the big questions I have as a designer of learning experiences is how do you get and maintain people's attention? Mm-hmm. And one of these theories, I mentioned it before, is this sort of neuroenergetic theory, which says that, okay, if I'm concentrating really fiercely in one area, I kind of use up the fuel in that area of the brain, and then all of a sudden, another area, which may be the area that's listening to, you know, listening to the radio at the same time while I'm trying to do this work over here, sort of has more fuel or more kind of energy, you know, like it isn't depleted, and so it basically kind of grabs the focus from area number one. And so one of the things that I'm personally experimenting with, I don't have very much, you know, actual research basis behind this, but is having some kind of low level distraction going on, very low level. Like I will turn on a movie that I've seen many times before, turn the volume down almost to the point where it's not audible, and I'll put it behind, so I can't actually see it. I can just hear it a little bit behind the document when I'm trying to work on something that's complicated or I've got a big writing task to do, just to see if I can kind of keep all those little, like, monkey mind things that want to grab my attention and pull me over here, pull me over here, pull me over here, just distracted enough that I can keep the main part of my focus on the you know, the main task. And stay in it.
Like, you're like baiting the monkey mind.
I am baiting the monkey mind. I'm totally baiting the monkey mind.
My God. Does that work?
It kind of works for me. I can't promise it'll work for anybody else. But it goes to this idea of kind of how does memory and attention and how does, you know, attention and focus and all of those kinds of things work. So so I would say that, yes, it works for me to bait the monkey mind. I can't promise it'll work for anybody else.
But, Julia, I'm feeling a sense of depression. I'll tell you why. There's not one single smartphone company that sat down and said, let's create these devices so that people can drive at 80 miles on the highway and try and send a text at the same time. So none of them set out to, it's almost as if they let the genie out of the bottle and they're like, oh my God, what are they doing? What am I doing? Mm-hmm. Why am I doing it? I have no idea. Well, we're making money, so who cares? So none of them decided that these devices weren't made to endanger lives, and that's what they're doing. Mm-hmm. So that's a fact, right? The other fact is one that I'm seeing in some of my programs, which is that managers have cottoned on to the fact that if I give a smartphone to my employee, all of a sudden I get more of his or her time. Mm-hmm. So I package up, this is more like a Trojan horse. I package up the smartphone in a nice box with a bow on top, and I give it to him or her as a Christmas gift, and I say, this is in recognition for the fine work you've done, Julie. You've worked really hard all year, and you know, I really like to make things easier for you, and so here's a smartphone. And you, if you're unaware, would say, oh, thank you so much. But what I really know is that I'm going to get you on Saturdays. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get you in the car. I'm going to get you on vacation. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get you when you're sick, lying in bed. I'm going to call you on that smartphone and you're going to answer, because the gift implies usage, and usage of a smartphone implies almost 24/7 access. In some companies, it's required. So here's my depressing thought, which is that technology and some managers who are using it towards evil ends are going so, it's developing so much faster than our capacity to effectively adapt. Mm-hmm. That all we're doing is putting ourselves at risk and then saying, oh no, we shouldn't do that. We should find a way to not do that. How do we not do that? I don't know. Pass a law. Okay, let's see if it works. Oh, it doesn't really work. What should I do personally? Oh my God, should I use a cognitive load theory or should I? Mm-hmm. We're so far behind where technology has already gone. The damage has to happen first. And we're using the text while driving example because it involves death, which is kind of obvious. Okay, we don't want that one. But between death and mild distraction, there is a whole range of unproductive behaviors that we don't seem to be... We only see them happening. Like I'm talking to somebody and all of a sudden he tries to maintain the conversation while he checks his email. Mm-hmm. So I sense the unproductivity because his responses get slower and he's not really listening. If I ask him, but you're not listening, you're checking your email. He says, no, man, I'm listening. And he goes right back into the email. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't know he's unproductive, but I am. So there's this whole world of unproductive, poor time management, poor self-management behaviors that have manifested. Technology keeps going faster than we can keep up I mean, do we have any hope here? I mean, we've got to move much, much faster with people like you and the work that you're doing. If we have a hope, because the gap is growing, is it not?
Yeah, well, and there's a lot of smart people who are kind of working on some of these problems. There's actually some really interesting conversation happening around the ethical issues of it, too, though. Mm. Because the more that, you know, I mean, one of the things that I have been thinking about is whether or not, you know, like, the next book should be designed for behavior change. But the issue with...
Sign me up.
The issue is that I think there's a greater ethical responsibility as a designer when you start kind of wading in these waters.
Tell me.
When you start kind of hacking people's automatic gestures, automatic functions, all of those sorts of things, you're treading very close to the area where you can manipulate people. You know, right. Yeah. If you read like Cialdini's book, Influence or things like that, you have to, you know, it tells you, like, for example, there are certain things that I know that I can do. I teach classes and there's certain things that I know that I can do at the end of a class if I want to increase the,
score on the smiley sheets.
Right.
Tell a good joke. Have a little laugh, competition, somebody wins, give out a gift.
Yes. You know, if I want to...
We know some of those, we designers know some of those tricks.
And so I have to ask the ethical question of is it okay to do that? You know, that kind of thing. And there's actually a very good talk, if you'd like, I'll find it to you, give it to you, if you want to, I don't know if you put in links in the podcast notes or whatever, but there's a really quite good talk from Mike Montero about the ethical responsibilities of designers. And he specifically uses an example of Facebook privacy settings. And I won't get into the detail of it, but you know, if those aren't well designed, you can wind up sharing information that you don't mean to share with people through no action of your own. And that can
That one is already happening, right?
Yeah. That
one's gone through. But I've witnessed an argument between a husband and a wife on Facebook, which amazing.
Right. And, you know, bad things can happen if you're not careful as a designer. And I think once we get into this area of designing for behavior change, those kinds of things that are specifically geared towards people's unconscious actions or biases or whatever, once you start playing in that space, you have to be very, very careful because... You know, Sebastian Detterding, who's, for my money, absolutely the smartest person out there on the gamification topic, has spent some time, and he has quite a good TEDx talk up when he talks about sort of the ethical responsibilities of designers, because if you can manipulate people's behavior through design, then, you know, you have to take that responsibility very, very seriously. And
I would think. I noticed that here in Jamaica, our mobile phone companies haven't taken the charge publicly in limiting texting while driving.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect my suspicion is there might be a reason that they get a lot of minutes. There's a lot of revenue to be gained from texting while driving. And if you start pushing this new behavior, people start actually following it, you'll actually see your revenue drop.
Mm-hmm.
This is my Machiavellian mind, but again, it goes to the sort of ethical question. But only they know, only they know the fact. Only Apple knows, what are the pieces of this thing that we need to tweak so that we can prevent someone from texting while driving?
Mm-hmm.
Because apparently there are things that they could do. They just decide not to do them. No, why? And if we were to look at the effect, somebody were to jump in a time capsule and arrive in 2014 from the year 2000,
mm-hmm.
and they'd say, see all these people texting and driving and all the carnage on the roads, they'd say, my God, what caused that?
Mm-hmm.
They go, oh, it's a smartphone that caused that.
Right.
Who designed a smartphone? They're the ones who are at fault. We don't see it that way, but I so agree with you. Is that there are effects that are happening that no one really seems to want to take responsibility for.
Mm-hmm.
They're already happening, no?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, are those subconscious though?
You know, some of it is unintentional. Like some bad design is, or you know, some bad choices are. You know, nobody saw that one coming.
yeah.
You know, it's some of it is. With the best rule in the world and the best thought out process in the world, we're still going to make some mistakes. And you know, that's going to happen. Some of it, you know, if you go back to your example of the boss giving the smartphone to the employee, that could be something that's happening at a tacit level, or it can be something that's happening at an overt level. So,
I don't know which one is better, by the way, ethically.
Well, I mean, I assume that tacit is better. You know, if you're a boss and you give a couple of employees smartphones and, hey, look, it seems like their productivity went up. So you go, okay, well, that's cool. And you give other employees smartphones because, you know, the employees of the original product, you know, their productivity went up. And you don't necessarily, like, make the connection between the fact that what you're doing now is infringing on their personal time. Like, you're getting work from them during times that you wouldn't normally have gotten, and that's why their productivity is going up. I can very easily see that being a scenario where, you know, somebody's like, hey, cool, productivity up, that's great, without having, you know, without really looking at, okay, why is their productivity going up? Oh, it's going up because I, guess what, I can now, you know, access them at 8 o'clock at night and get them to do stuff that ordinarily they wouldn't have done till the next day.
Right.
Or get them while they're sick, or get them, you know, whenever.
Right.
You know, I think there's less. I think intent matters, but that's, you know, that's a philosophical point of view.
Right. But do we as designers, though, is it part of our job? I think it is part of our job to help people to not necessarily the bosses and the apples of the designers of the world, but at least the users to become conscious. And to open, have their minds open to what is happening right in the middle of their own lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which
is that part of our job?
I think it is, which is why I like talking about the things that, taking some of the tacit practices that people have and helping them be aware of it when they're, because that's that, you know, we do all of these sorts of things unconsciously, and if we can raise them to the conscious level, we can manipulate them better, which is kind of where the sort of life hacking or, you know, things like that kind of come in. If I can take something and understand why I'm doing it, I can do a better job of planning for it or planning around it or changing the environment around it or things like that. So I feel like that's a very legitimate, you know, space for me to be in and talking about. Manipulating people, that's a tougher one. That one I have a lot of kind of concerns about. So that's a different, you know, trying to keep it in, you know, making somebody aware of hyperbolic discounting, I feel like helps them understand their own actions better.
Right. Well, it also helps them to understand. Let's put it this way. Let's say that right now life is being hacked from the outside. That technology is changing, and it is causing either unconscious behaviors or unavoidable behaviors. It's definitely happening. Mm-hmm. It's already happened. And unless we hack back, so to speak, unless we become conscious and then look at our behaviors and then learn how to manage to change them in response to all that's happening, then we'll just be at the effect. We'll become so unproductive.
Yep.
And in so many different ways that the technology actually won't benefit us, no?
Yeah, and I think that that's very much sort of the situation, and that you were sort of talking about technology's changing so fast, what the heck can we possibly do about it? And one of the defenses is to be more visibly aware of what's going on in our environment, or what's going on, you know, more visibly aware of design and rewards, and you know how all of those things impact us. So, you know, being able to kind of make better choices, or being able to kind of adjust your environment so that things work better, you know, all of those kinds of things, I think, are really important.
Being able to practice, like you say in your book, so that your skills get better.
Mm-hmm.
Practice. I don't exactly know how to do something like this, but practice. Not answering the phone when it rings when you're driving.
Yeah. Well, and there's a whole new, like, I'm thinking considering whether I want to do a second edition, and I would probably put in a whole new chapter kind of on habit formation, because it's different than skill development. And I think that that's an area that's much tougher, because it needs to be that kind of almost you need to practice it enough until you get to an almost that level of automaticity about it. But that's a really interesting area, because a lot of times, you know, again, it's not a knowledge problem. It's a problem of creating a new habit or changing an existing habit.
And we seem to be, we're unaware of the hacking that is happening to us. We're unaware, or we think it's unavoidable. But B, sort of where your book sort of sits, is that we don't know how to teach ourselves to respond, to it in an effective way, where we flounder. The elephant wins every time, and we don't even know the distinction between rider and elephant. So our knowledge is missing, our skills are low, and we're unable to come back. We're unable to compensate. So, for example, I imagine that in the future, if a boss does say, "Congratulations, Happy Christmas, here's a smartphone," an employee could say, "Oh, wonderful. I'm going to need some training." "Huh? Yeah, there are about 5 habits I don't want to learn, like driving while texting," and they could lift them up. And it's, "So I'm going to need about $1,000 training program that I could take over here in Seattle, so that before I even start using the smartphone."
There you go.
And the boss goes, "What are you talking about? You don't need all." And the person said, "Well, it costs benefit, and you know, I don't want to endanger my children's health, and people get divorced." And they could cite some numbers and say, "I need, you know, these are the kind of habits that are needed to manage this new technology you're putting into my hand." Is that far-fetched?
I kind of like it, actually.
It's like a tax.
There you go.
"Oh, sure, I'll take your smartphone. Here's a tax." The tax is 2 days of training. I put in this special app that turns it off while it's moving while it's in a car. You buy this new thing. It's like buying a headset. If you give me a smartphone, I have to have a headset, and you have to buy it for me. Because that's at least safer than just answering the phone.
Yeah, I read a blog post years ago where this woman was talking about how, you know, she had a tendency to be running late, and when she was actually in her car, she would feel herself driving faster, and she was like, "Well, this isn't really safe. I mean, this is sort of fundamentally unsafe." And so she actually just put a piece of tape over the clock in her car, because she's like, "Once I'm in the car, if I'm driving at a safe rate, I will get there when I get there. And anything else is not an okay trade-off." You know?
So she takes away the anxiety of being late, which would then have her press the accelerator.
Yeah. You know, and I mean, she's still late sometimes or whatever it is, but ultimately it's not worth having a car accident to be there a few minutes earlier. You know, she can try to adjust the behavior, but once she's actually in the car, she shouldn't change her behavior based on being late. It's too late at that point. She should drive she should drive at the rate she needs to drive to be safe.
Here's the big question. This might be the last one, because unfortunately we're at the top of the hour. I can't believe it. But what's the insight that she had? What's the level of inner awareness and then innovation? Because she had to be aware of something, and then she had to figure out the solution, and then she had to implement it. So there's at least 3 steps.
Right. Well, and it goes to the
bottom. Where'd that come from? How does she have it and everybody else, the rest of us, not have it? How come?
Well, and this goes to what I'm talking about when I say that I'd like to dissect why I'm procrastinating about something. When I'm feeling procrastinating, what is it? Is it anxiety? Is it just a boring task? Because, you know, quite frankly, expense reports, it's just tedious. You know, I procrastinate about those because it's just tedious. You know, so can I watch a movie, or can I do something entertaining while I'm doing that, and then I don't mind so much? Or is it an anxiety thing? I think I'm not sure I know enough about the task to be sure I'm going to do it right, and so I'm going to put it off because that I have anxiety attached to it. Or is it, is it something else? Is it that there's something that's distracting me that wants to pull me in, and I want to do that instead? You know, can I stem that distraction somehow? So being able to kind of say, all right, this isn't working for me right now. Let me actually put the magnifying glass over what's not working and start to see if I can't tug the strings and figure out why it's not working. What's the emotional component to it? What's the, you know, what's the situational and environmental component to it? What's the, what are the triggers that are causing this to happen? And then are there solutions that I can come up with? So I think that's the, you know,
Holy Grail.
Yeah, is being able to kind of look at our own, specifically our own automatic things, and understand them better.
A level and a degree and a skill of self-diagnosis that right now we're just sort of scratching the surface at.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, I mean, we need to get better tools to understand that stuff, but not... Because I, like, for example, I get very annoyed with a lot of the discussion around cognitive bias, because it's a big discussion where people talk about biases and stuff like that. And the problem with the discussion of cognitive bias is that it usually talks about only the bad instances of this cognitive bias. So, like, a cognitive bias is you have an affinity for people who are like you.
Oh, yes.
And that's a cognitive bias. So if you meet somebody and they went to school in a similar circumstance, or they're dressed like you, or they're the same age, or you have some other thing in common or whatever, you feel this affinity for them. And this is a functional behavior most of the time. Yeah. If you're hiring and you're only hiring people who are like you, and particularly like you in certain key criteria, then it turns into a problem.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. I read some of the popular press on it recently, and some of the hiring is done, like, if you have a certain kind of name, cognitive bias kicks in. The person doesn't even know that it kicks in.
Yep. And taking those behaviors from being sort of invisible and tacit and making them visible and, you know, can really help people kind of develop strategies around it. But one of the conversations is if we just say that this is a bias that's bad, then we're not helping people distinguish between when I'm using it and it's okay and when I'm using it and it's a problem. Because a lot of times having an affinity for somebody like you is how you make friends. It's how you meet people. It's how you, you know, develop relationships. It's not a bad thing intrinsically, but when you're using it in certain contexts, it becomes a bad thing.
Oh, it's so true. I did, years ago when I was single, I was on Match.com, and they had this one test that you could do. And what they did was flash different faces in front of you, different races, different shapes, different everything. And, you know, it started off and, you know, your brain is like, okay, I like people from all different backgrounds. Oh yeah, she looks good. She looks good. And then it sped up. Mm-hmm. And by the end of the test, I was appalled. I had no affinity for redheads.
Oh, funny. Interesting.
Where did that come from? I flash back and I somehow remember a teacher that I had when I was like about 6 years old who was a redhead. She wasn't my teacher, so a teacher in a different class. And I had some interaction with her that left me with like, I don't like her. And I swear that's what it took me back to.
Oh.
I was appalled. I blamed myself for something. I was like, oh my God, I'm biased. I'm a bigot. I had a clear preference that I didn't even know that I had.
Yeah.
The test, it was so fast you couldn't think about your choices. You were just responding. And my God, we do have it.
Yeah.
So we have a whole bunch of work to do on ourselves. If we don't do it, it sounds as if, you know, would be in big trouble.
Yeah.
That's bottom line.
Well, and that's, you know, when you're talking about time management, you know, if we talk about sports, I mean, that's what really great sports coaches do. So if somebody's, you know, if Tiger Woods, you know, golf coach is helping him improve his swing or improve something about his swing, what they're doing is they're taking things that happen automatically, so the physical feel of swinging and things like that, and they're using video cameras or they're using computer analysis or they're using, you know, whatever, to take the things that are happening automatically or implicitly or tacitly and make them explicit and visible and tacit so that they can start to kind of monkey with it. And a lot of time, you know, and adjust and change things consciously. Mm-hmm. So a lot of our behaviors, be it time management or anything else, if we can figure out ways to take things that we're doing implicitly, like what are the triggers that always send me over to my email instead of staying focused on my current task, and start looking, understanding explicitly what what causes me to do this, or what causes me to do this, or what causes me to do this, or what under what circumstances, or things like that, then we can start actually hacking them a little bit more, and we can start actually kind of working with them. And, you know, obviously that's why, you know, the five whys, where you just kind of keep asking, like, okay, why did I do this? Well, why did I do, you know, but why, but right. why, but why? You know, that's a really nice place to start, so...
Right, and at the end of the day, we could actually participate in forming new behaviors, as opposed to sort of watching them happen and wonder why. We could actually be at the cause rather than just trying to diagnose where it came from. No.
Yep. Yes, absolutely. You could form an implementation attention about it, or, you know, things like that. So.
Oh my God! World peace. Yeah. Oh, Julie, it's been an awesome conversation. We might need a glossary of terms. We went over so many powerful concepts that I'm gonna have I might have to put one together, I think, or ask you to define some of the terms, or at least tell us where we could find definition of some of them for those of who are listening who haven't heard them before, because they are right now they are the state of the art. These are the terms we need to use if we want to accomplish the result that we talked about, where we're able to understand ourselves at this level. It's sort of where it's at right now. It's not been Disneyfied yet. It's not been simplified. It is sort of complex. The terms are a little bit tricky. Some of them, implementation intentions, cognitive load, cognitive bias, dissonance, hyperbolic discourse, just a few of the ones I wrote down.
Yeah, if you give me the list, I'll give you links on all of that stuff. So.
All right, great. And so I really want to thank you for coming on the show. How can people, we just touched on a little small piece of all that you're about. How can they find out more? And actually, again, for people who are working on their own time management systems, the stuff that you have, the content and the ideas that you have are so important for us developing our own upgrades and improving our own systems that it's worth it to go to the level that you've gone in terms of definition. How can they get more information outside of your book, Design for How People Learn, which is available on Amazon?
Good question. Some of the people who are doing interesting things, there's BJ Fogg, who's doing a lot of stuff with habits. And he's out of Stanford. I'm pretty sure it's bjfogg.com or .org, one of those. But I can get you that link. So that's an option. I do think that Roy Baumeister, the one out of Florida, has a book called Willpower, which I think is actually really great. If you're just interested in kind of design and how, you know, the whole idea of designing the environment for, you know, how do you make the environment work better for people or facilitate things better? The really classic book on that is The Design of Everyday Things by Donald Norman. That's the sort of Bible on that one.
Mm-hmm. And to get in touch with you and with more of your work and your ideas, because the thing is, you translate a lot of that gobbledygook into like really simple language, which is why I love your book so much. How can people get more of Julie?
I blog at usablelearning.com, mm-hmm. And you can find information about there. And I'm setting up an implementation intention about blogging more regularly there this year, so...
Yay.
I can make that happen.
I vote for that because I went to your blog this afternoon and I was almost late for the call because I was like, oh my God, it is so interesting. So I strongly endorse your blog.
Oh, thank you.
And your more blogging. Yes, please do.
A lot of the basic principles are in the book. One of the chapters is also freely available at the website, usablelearning.com. If you go to the book link, and it's actually specifically the book on designing for these kinds of behavior change things. So if people want to go read that chapter, they're welcome to do it. And,
Great. Are you on Twitter also?
I am on Twitter also as Usable Learning, and it's usable, USABLE learning.com.
Is the Twitter handle at Usable Learning?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay, great. Great. Julie Dirksen, it's been a pleasure. I want to keep talking with you, but I have to keep our podcast to a manageable length. So thanks so much for being on our show today. It's been awesome talking with you. Thanks for the work you're doing. Thanks for your book. Thanks for your blog. Thanks for your effort. It's paying off here in Jamaica with people like me who are looking for ways to help people around the world manage their time better, because we are time management learning isn't anywhere where it could be if we use the kind of ideas that you have in your book. So thanks for coming on our show.
Oh, well, thank you so much. It's been really, really fun to talk about it. So
great, great. And to our listeners, thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Two Time Labs podcast. Stay tuned. There'll be others coming up in the future with other thought leaders like Julie Dirksen. And thanks for listening in. Take care and all the best.